as per usual. Bob and Al's wish. Just be available to you.
You want to wait two more minutes or?
Whatever you want to do, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. I'm convening this meeting of the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. This is May 25th. We have a one work session on the agenda. So I am opening the work session. Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, the Integrated Eligibility, Medicaid Eligibility Project. Great. Would you please start us off?
Certainly, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, as per usual, Mr. Cummings and I, Dr. Cummings and I, split the portfolio of oversight, and this is an agency that Dr. Cummings is overseeing, so we'll go ahead and switch places, and if the committee needs me for any reason, I'll just be over in the corner. So, thank you, Bob.
We put him in the corner, did we? Yes.
That's right.
More than me. Okay, we're here today to take a look at the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility Project request. As described in the LFO analysis and recommendations memo posted on OLIS, the Department of Human Services has submitted a request to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for funding for the one Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility 1 IE and ME project. With this request, project funding in the 2017-19 biennium will be $219.6 million total, which represents about 91% of the overall estimated project cost of $241.7 million total funds. The request also includes 175 permanent and limited duration positions, 126.04 FTEs through the end of the biennium. DHS estimates that the project will take 39 months to execute, with completion estimated by June 2019. The figures above include an associated package from the Oregon Health Authority budget that requests $15.2 million total funds in 62 of the requested positions, ongoing maintenance and operational costs for an estimated 10 to 15-year system lifespan are not included in the figures above and are being reestimated at this time. The purpose of this request is to continue the implementation resources needed to transfer Kentucky's Human Services Eligibility Determination functionality to Oregon, where it will be integrated with the recently installed Oregon One Eligibility System 1. This software was also transferred successfully from Kentucky. With this additional functionality, the One and ME system will be able to also determine the eligibility for non-MAGI Medicaid categorical eligibility for aged, blind and disabled, supplemental nutritional assistance program, SNAP, temporary assistance for needy families, TANF, and employment-related daycare, ERDC. With that, I'll introduce myself for the record. I'm Bob Cummings, and I'll remind those who are come up and speak that you should introduce yourself for the record first. The DHS sponsors for this project are here today to provide an overview of this project and requested resource requirements. Please introduce yourselves for the record.
And while you're making your way up, I will ask Mr. Cummings for one point of clarification. You mentioned 39 months, but the completion date is less than 39 months from now. That's because 39 months started some time ago. So it was a total of 39. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Nathanson. Co-Chair Nathan Riley, for the record, it is indeed 39 total duration because there's not 39 months left between now and the end date of this. So that is correct.
Credit for time served.
Thank you.
I saw the same thing.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Eric Smith. I'm the independent project director for the One IE and ME project. I'll ask the directors to introduce themselves in a moment because they'll be speaking shortly. Quickly, I just wanted to give you an overview of what we'll be looking at today. Our directors will give us a history of the project just to refresh the committee. Talk a bit about the vision for integrated eligibility and the challenges to integrating eligibility that we've been dealing with. I'll discuss the impact analysis that the project has conducted based on the work that's been going on the last several months. At that time, with your permission, I'd like to excuse the directors and ask Nate Singer to come join me for the rest of the presentation, where we'll talk about the scope, schedule, budget, risks, and then our next steps.
And there's something that I apologize for not telling my LFO analyst and getting word to you ahead of time. There's something I would like you to address, even if it's just from a very general 100,000 foot level. There will probably be anxiety about budget and program and policy changes at the federal level. So could you please tell us the degree to which the work that would be completed is applicable regardless of whatever rules or dollars change at the federal level? Is this going to still be valuable 100% or 90%? I think everyone would want to know the answer.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Lynn Saxton, the director of the Oregon Health Authority. It's a pleasure to be with you today, and I just want to summarize. This is kind of where we've been and where we're going and the steps along the way. And as you all know, we began in 2014 building a platform for Medicaid eligibility, and progressed from there to spending 2015 getting the One system stood up, which was completed by the end of the year as planned and as necessary for the outstanding litigation at that time. And then in 2016, we began a year-long process of taking the data of Medicaid members and getting it into the One system. And we made a commitment in 2015 to spend 2016 getting that done correctly. And that has been a laborious process, but that will produce dividends for us on the go-forward basis in terms of data information accuracy and data entry accuracy. And now we have completed the first cycle of renewals in our eligibility system. We did that in spring of this year. And again, renewals is the annual process to renew your eligibility for Medicaid. Just want to be clear on that point. And we're in the anticipated process of cleaning up the remainders, the cleanup cases, as we call them, which is about 115,000 plus members. And we have begun the preparation for the IE, ME work that is before us. We are very pleased to be part of that process supporting DHS, and very pleased, of course, to have Eric leading our team. I will underscore that one of the things we were talking about in the hall just before we came in is taking this step at this time is consistent and coherent with whatever policy emerges on the federal level. When the Medicaid system was stood up in 2013, 2014, the expansion under the ACA, there was an expectation that the majority of the expansion population would be not DHS, traditional Medicaid members. As it turns out, we don't have the final numbers, but about 60 to 80% of the expansion population access DHS services of another kind. So centralizing the capacity at this point and simplifying our processes will be to Oregon's advantage, whatever direction the federal government goes. And we're excited about being on track with that. That's part of the reason we took the time to get this formulated correctly, is we believe it will produce efficiencies for the state of Oregon going forward and will make this system more effective for our members.
So Chair Nathanson and Chair Riley, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Director, Department of Human Services. The next slide is really what our vision for integrated eligibility is, and it's really to have one system that determines the eligibility now for MAGI, non-MAGI Medicaid, SNAP, TANF, and ERDC. It really is a vision in which someone can come in and provide kind of the core information we ask of people
as they go through an eligibility process. And really, instead of having to provide it four or five different times, really just come to a place where they can provide that information once and then have a system that determines what services that person is eligible for. And also, in talking about increased efficiency and effectiveness, setting up a kind of a process where they can go into an office, they can go online, or they can go through a web portal, or they could, in some cases, do it by phone. But trying to make the process as efficient and as streamlined for our clients as possible.
This is, we wanted to outline some of the challenges of integration between the agencies. And just from the OHA side of the equation, the one system in its implementation was challenging for the expansion population, in part because it was built with components still needed to be added at a later date. As you'll recall, it was built to be stood up live in December 2015 to comply with the deadline of the Oracle litigation over Cover Oregon. So we were on track and implemented a simplified system to start so that we could meet that deadline, which we did, and now we're adding improvements and components. We're very focused, as you may have heard earlier this week, on completing the work not only of eligibility but the maturation of the one system. We are minimizing manual workarounds as we go forward, and I'm happy to talk about eligibility determinations and backlog management, but effectively we reach our first benchmark on May 31st and a second benchmark on August 31st, where we will have all the outstanding remainder or cleanup cases completed.
So from the DHS perspective, it really is a large and complex project because you're not just dealing with different programs, but in many cases, different federal agencies who have oversight of these programs, and so different funding sources. I think in the beginning, underestimated how much involvement we would need with the health authority, because maybe overestimated, and this is one that Lynn didn't, we did, what the functionality was around the one system and what we were going to have to do to add our Medicaid piece and to integrate the one system into the rest of the project. And then really for us, we do have a sense of urgency because we are getting some enhanced federal match to help fund a project. And so we want to move this forward. Eric has always told us we have a sense of urgency. We're going to move this forward. But quality, it has to be kind of job one. And we all agree with that. So just wanted to briefly talk about the actions taken by the agencies to move forward. You know, we met quite a bit, and to be honest with you, I think Lynn and I will both tell you that in the beginning the meetings were a little contentious, a little tense. But I think once we engaged an outside facilitator, Coraggio Group, to come in, we began to have the kind of conversations we needed to have and really got down to business about talking about what the issues were and what the possible solutions and where accountability and responsibility with the project lies. And I think that was a really key piece. Lynn and I have worked very closely together. We're on the same page. We have a common vision. And we have been very clear with our staff what that vision is and what our expectations are of each and every one of them. We worked with Dr. Pettit at the Office of the State CIO, and he's been a great help in moving the project forward. In defining a governance structure, we signed and created an MOU between the two agencies. And I think this is one decision we came to, which wasn't an easy decision and took a lot of conversation, but I think it's the right decision. And it was to move the eligibility function for Medicaid from the health authority to DHS. And so now the eligibility for all the programs within the system will be done by one agency, which is Department of Human Services, with a lot of help and support from our sister agency at the health authority. These changes and this process did result in changes to scope and schedule, and also increased the budget, as Nate will present later. And right now, Eric, since he's been on board, has done a lot of good work and has been working on an impact analysis. So I'm going to turn it over to him to kind of walk you through that.
Thank you. So as you can imagine, the time that it took to come to the decisions that were made and the changes in the business processes that were just discussed required the project to step back. And I want to say up front that the oversight folks, both at the LFO and at the Office of the CIO, were very involved even before I got there to help the project identify the roadmap for how do you reassess where you're at, what are the steps we need to take to make sure the governance bodies buy into whether we go forward or what we do differently. And so the next couple slides, I just want to walk through briefly what that impact analysis looked like. On this slide, you'll just see a couple of options that were being considered was, do you change the scope of the project? Do you remove some of the portions of the current approach? Do you delay the project and go back and do some more business modeling and business analysis? Do you just focus the resources on the one system that's in production and continue those enhancements and exclude the DHS programs for now? Or do you cancel the project altogether? And so the whole gamut of options were considered by those that were involved. I won't go over all of these evaluation criteria that were in play, but I'd highlight three of them. The first one is business complexity. You've heard it over and over in this committee that the legacy environment we're in, and I'll have a slide and a couple of slides that'll highlight it, is something that's increasingly difficult to maintain and to support our business needs. And so there's a real motivation to move into a more modern technology. And it also will help us be more successful in providing the services that we've talked about, which goes to the second criteria, which is incline impact. The real driver here is to help government be more efficient, to help Oregonians to get the services they need in a way that's more effective for them, and to allow staff to operate more effectively in how they provide those services. And then the last criteria I would just highlight is the budget requirement that Director Psyche just mentioned, that there is a real advantage to do as much of this work as quickly as we can to get the federal fund sharing. As a part of the impact analysis, one of the things we considered is the consequences of not doing the project, and those bullets are in line with what we've already talked about. Oregonians lose the opportunity to access benefits more effectively, increasing risk over time the more you rely on legacy systems to do the work, and then the opportunity for the funding. And then the benefits of the project, I think you can see on the slide, we've discussed many of those already. One of the things I'd point out is that with one system, we will have better information as well to manage the systems, to help with the policymaking process. And so that's also an outcome that we're looking forward to, and that was key in our determination to go forward, which is the next slide. We recommended to the steering committee, and then the steering committee recommended to the Joint Governance Board, which consists of Director Psyche, Director Saxton, and Alex, the CIO, to continue moving forward with the transfer solution. The transfer solution approach is not unique to Oregon. In fact, from my assessment coming in just a couple months ago, I would say Oregon's behind the curve compared to many other states around the country with regard to how they're automating this type of service in their states. And we're learning a lot from those other states. The staff that's working on the project has talked to over 20 different states. And part of the lessons learned that we've heard from other states are folded into the replanning effort that's been going on since the impact analysis. I think I covered everything on this slide. I would just say that the steering committee and the joint governance board did approve our recommendation to go forward with our current approach of implementing the transfer solution. And with that, I'd like to, unless, was your question answered, Co-Chair Nathanson, that you had asked at the beginning? Okay.
I'm satisfied.
If I could invite Nate Singer to join me now. And while Nate's joining us, so given what we know today, and the reason why I think that's important is when you're doing a project like this, you're continuously learning more and more about what it takes to be successful to implement it. To improve access, to create the effectiveness and the workflows, we really want to try to align with the transfer solution the best we can. And the decision that was made for DHS to do the eligibility determination actually was a benefit to the project because it does align the business process with the system that we're trying to implement. I think the thing that's coming into focus more clearly now, legacy systems have always been in scope. You can't do a project like this without understanding that you need to make modifications to or retire legacy systems. But I think the efforts that are underway now since the FITGAP process to really dig into the design phase of the legacy systems are bringing a fresh perspective of the complexity of our legacy systems, and I'll demonstrate in a moment with a couple of slides. Data conversion. The scope of data conversion, how successful we can be with the data conversion from our legacy systems to this system is something that's, it's not a change in scope, but it's an increased understanding of the complexity of the scope. We also, as the agencies have decided to align their business model where DHS does all eligibility, there's a transition plan that's being put into place now to transition from OHA resources and those processes to DHS. And so the project is actively involved in helping the business with their development of that plan and being informed from that in terms of what the project needs to do, prepare for those services to be provided by DHS. And then the last thing I'd point out is that we originally thought that the disaster recovery efforts would be done as a part of maintenance and operations. Those are substantial enough. We're going to bring those back into the project and make sure that that kind of work is being done as a part of the project and not just a part of the maintenance operations of the project. Two slides here. Oversimplified slides, if I may, but to make a point. So Kentucky, when they put in their integrated eligibility system, they had already provided services, the services we're talking about, they were integrated. And they already had a legacy system that had one system that was providing the functionality for that integrated eligibility process. And so when Kentucky put in the new system, the one that we're transferring to Oregon, they had a simpler business problem to solve. And the legacy system was able to be retired after they cut over to the new system. In Oregon, we first are aligning the business process and the business model to move some of the eligibility work from OHA to DHS. So that's step one. That's the transition process I was describing. But because we've been doing eligibility in a more siloed fashion in Oregon, we have multiple legacy systems who have been providing support to those processes. And so we are having to migrate or convert data from at least four legacy systems, key legacy systems, to one system instead of one system like Kentucky did. And then there are a number of other subsystems. There's 17 systems that are front and center in scope that will probably need some sort of design work or rework that will also need to be addressed as we are modifying the legacy systems to do this work. The other challenge with Oregon is that because the scope of the project won't take in everything that DHS and OHA do, most of these legacy systems are going to need to survive the project. They'll need to be reconfigured to do remaining work that's not in scope for this project. And so instead of retiring the legacy systems, these systems are going to have to be reconfigured and tested and to make sure that they're going to provide the remaining functionality for those folks that are going to continue to receive services from those systems. And that's a much different business challenge than Kentucky had.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So does this mean that once we're through with this one, you're going to be back to start replacing those legacy systems? Is that what I'm hearing?
I would imagine over the long run, I'm looking to Kristen Deuce, the OIS CIO, that over the long haul, yes. I mean, we're going to have to eventually, over the years, move to a more modern platform. And I got an affirmative yes.
Yeah, I see that. Thank you.
Okay. So that's just an overview of the scope challenges we're facing. The other thing I'd wanted to just briefly bring to your attention deals with the schedule. Again, given what we know today, and I would say understanding the scope and the complexity of the legacy work, which is what we're doing over the next few months. We're in design phase for that now, and then we'll build a schedule, is really going to be probably the driver for the timeline for this project. I think if we just had to do the modernization work that's going on in IEME, we could fix that schedule. But because legacy has to do the things it needs to do in partnership with IEME, understanding how long that's going to take and the scope of that work is going to be critical to determining the overall timeline for this project. Just a few things. We've mentioned some of these already with regard to the impact of schedule. I talked about the second slide about talking with other states. One of the things we've paid attention to is lessons learned, the fourth bullet down, even through the process that OHA went through in bringing in the one system. And those of you who've worked with me at the Department of Revenue project, we paid a lot of attention to making sure the employees were ready to do their job. And in this case, it's even more critical because there are a number of employees that will be doing a new job. And so we're really making sure we focus on the change leadership efforts and the business process readiness efforts and what it's going to take to make sure the staff are ready to do their work once we go live with the new system. I touched on data conversion already and the complexity of that.
I'd like to stop you there.
Yes.
Yes, it was mentioned, but I really get a lot out of examples of real things. Give me an example of some kind of data that's difficult to convert and under what kind of data you would choose not to convert, and what does that mean, you're not converting it? We're still going to have paper files of something?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathan Singer. I'm one of the business directors on the Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility Project. Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, that's a very good question in one of the areas that as we look at the system as a whole and data conversion, there's a lot of complexities to these programs. So, for example, food stamps, SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the way we construct a household is different than how we construct a household for the aging, blind, and disabled Medicaid and for the MAGI Medicaid structure. And so when we look at a household structure of who belongs in that, and then we calculate eligibility, we look at income, we look at who's involved in those households and where we get that information. And each system may calculate it or capture it a little bit differently. And some of our systems actually roll up that information and combine it at the household level, and some capture it at the individual level. And so because of that, the complexities of determining which information is correct at what time when we do redeterminations at different periods of time can make data conversion a very complex topic. It's one of the areas that, as we've talked to many other states, we've talked to over 20-some states around this, data conversion has been one of those areas that some states have seen increased success as they've had singular systems. They've already had more data integration, and some have harder times. A simpler example that really shows this is address. I use this a lot when talking to individuals. An address for an individual should be a simple thing, but depending on what time they turn to what address or what household composition that can be, whether it's a mailing address, whether or not someone is in a domestic violence situation, it's extremely important that we understand what address should be combined with what group of individuals, and that people's ultimately their safety and security and their information goes to the right locations. And so those are some of the aspects that we have to look at.
I certainly appreciate the recognition, for example, at the address example. I appreciate that you recognize the difference, but we're also, probably all of us on this committee, used to using systems that maintain multiple addresses for the same individual person. And one can be a mailing address, a residence, an alternative address, and you mark one as preferred or one as confidential. So in that old-fashioned phrase, it's not rocket science. You just need to recognize it. I understand that you have to get it right for each person, but it's just data management.
And Co-Chair Nathan, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, I think I shared actually last time I was here, I said it's something to the effect of simply complex. it should be very simple. You're absolutely right. In some of our systems, we have very clean data to be able to look and say, for this individual, we have the right data sets for those. For address, I can look and see the mailing address, or if it's an authorized representative, a family member acting on behalf of them, and so their address goes there.
Great.
In other parts of our systems, because of the age of the systems, what data has been collected, the processes that have been there for, you know, decades, we don't have as clear indicators on that. And so, again, that's part of the activities we are engaging Deloitte as the system integrator through, and part of the deliverables they have for us is to determine, they call it a spider web logic, and it confuses me like a spider web at times, but looking at truly how we connect the data and how we can look at this and seeing what opportunities there really are to pull and get the right data so that way we can be farther ahead down the road.
Good. And, for example, if we know that we've been not recording information with as much detail as we should have been, are we already changing business processes so that starting now we are asking the right questions and all of the right questions and recording it right, or we're going to wait until 2019 to start asking the questions that we need to?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, I'm going to give you the both answers. So we are looking at opportunities to collect and capture more information. One clarification, you know, we're asking the questions we have to. It's whether or not we have the system capacity to store that in a way that then we'd be able to pull back from. Mm-hmm. As we look at all of our legacy systems, you know, and working with OIS, with Kristen as our CIO and working with OIS leadership, we've identified areas as we look at those legacy systems that remain and how we can do it in a more streamlined fashion, how we can find ways to align our data easier for futures. But right now, that's one of the struggles we are trying to identify is how could we capture that information now to use it later? Many of the states, that's part of their process they did is as development occurred, they looked at business processes to see how they could have cleaner data or more efficient data to really to convert. We will have to look at our process and see what we can actually capture to move forward with those areas.
Thank you.
So, if I may, having done a few conversions and merges, especially, I've merged some banks, and you would think merging two banks would be really easy because they do the same stuff. It's not. And it takes a long time in advance to determine how those pieces of data relate to each other and to figure out how you build that database to contain all those different pieces of information that you haven't yet figured out how they relate to each other. And I think this is a very similar situation. I understand that it takes a lot of analysis up front before you can actually build that database. And you can't start collecting the data in that way until the database is built. So I get that. But I get concerned about the fact that we're not doing all that legacy stuff and getting that data analysis done before we create the database that we're creating now.
Or in the process, right? Yeah. Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, we're actually in the data conversion design process right now. And so we just launched that here a few weeks ago. And so we're in that stage of the design and discovering exactly those types of things. And where is the data? When we start doing some mock conversions later this fall is what's currently scheduled, then you'll be able to see where is the data, where are the data anomalies, what data needs to be cleaned, what data works. And so there's a great deal of rigor that goes into once you understand first what data is available and then what data are we going to convert, how will that map to the new system, how's it going to be used in the new system. Then when you start actually practicing with that, with the converted data, how does that behave? And then we have some real choices about if it's not behaving well, do we convert it at all? Do we have some back-end processes where we need to fill in those gaps on the business side? And so there's a great deal of rigor that goes into data conversion. And we are just in the initial stages of doing the data conversion design discussions right now.
Follow up, if I may. And so you're looking at all those legacy systems that will eventually feed in?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, there's four systems that are in scope that we think are the four main systems that we will be converting the data from. And yes, those are the systems we're looking at right now, if I understand correctly.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Those were in this slide, A, B, C, D. Those are the four main systems that are going to be in play.
But if you, through Q, we're not looking at currently?
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, we explored in the fit gap part of the project around what systems would have the majority of the information that we do need today to convert to be able to do eligibility. And so we've explored those already and looked at them. Many of them, as you can see from the drawing, would connect or roll up to those larger systems. Okay. And so that's what our staff in working with Deloitte have identified as key systems to utilize.
Okay, thank you.
Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your third bullet point up there, Oregon rules and policies are requiring more customization. How do we get away from the customization so we're duplicating other systems? I mean, if you need rules and regulations here, it may be bills that are well done to streamline so we're duplicating, I mean, as many states that have the same system. The cost of computers, I think it's, what, $247 million you're talking about here? It just seems incredible. Also, the legacy systems, I assume we're replacing all the legacy systems, but it sounds like we're doing it piecemeal. To quote our chair, is not rocket scientist, right?
It's close.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator DeBoer, was there a question that I should be responding? I'm sorry if I
No, I think it was more of a statement to urge you for rules and policies is to start streamlining ours instead of customizing, because what I see the main part of cost is we take an off-the-shelf system and then we customize it to ourselves rather than change our rules and regulations to standardize.
Okay, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator DeBoer, I think this is really a system that was built for Kentucky and that we're transferring it to Oregon. So it's not necessarily a cost solution. It was custom built for Kentucky. I mean, Deloitte's in this line of business. I think they're in two or three dozen states around the country, right, doing this line of work. And so they've got some basic system that we're using, but this was built for Kentucky, and the analysis that was done to decide how to solve for this problem was to look at what state had a system close enough to Oregon that we could transfer into Oregon, and we knew we would have to customize. It's much different than the COT solution that when I've been before you with the Department of Revenue, where in revenue we were able to manage our business processes and change workflows to the business process with only three law changes. We only came to you for three law changes in revenue to do that without customization. This one, Kentucky, just they have different laws for some of these. So in some cases, they even interpreted federal law differently than we do. And so there's just things that we need to do in order to be in line with Oregon and federal laws and rules to be able to perform. Did I answer that?
Just to follow up, Madam Chair. And that's precisely what I'm talking about. Out of all the states, we need to start standardizing them.
Thank you.
I mean, so I just think if you start standardizing, customization in computers is terribly expensive, and every time you have a change, it's terribly expensive.
Thank you, Senator.
So we need to quit passing laws.
Representative Nierman and then Senator Lincoln.
I'll pick up his point because I don't think you're answering his question, or at least it's causing a question in me, is and I'll invoke the ghost of Senator Johnson, who has said this is why God made the legislature. What are there any laws that we could pass or repeal that could take a big whack out of the complexity on this? And that's maybe not a question you can answer right now, but please consider that an offer of this committee.
At least one member.
At least one member.
Yes.
Not a blank check, but.
Right. I think Senator DeBoer made a great point, and Rep. Nierman followed up. What's interesting about your response was you said Deloitte has between 2 and 3 dozen. Well, if it's 3 dozen, that's 36 different states. How many of those are similar? For example, we found Kentucky close to us, but if the other 12 in that mix are all running the same off-the-shelf version, then we should be striving to get into the off-the-shelf worldview. Our worldview is twisted or distorted just enough that we don't fit those models, but it would be a higher strategy than you guys at the information system level. But I think it's good to get on the record that we ought to, as the legislature, we ought to strategize on becoming a common core, if you will, right? We ought to get into the main vein of it would have been better for you, Co-Chair Riley, if banks would have run their businesses the same.
Yeah.
And that they didn't, there's a mix. I was involved in a conversion where I think we took 253 subsidiary companies and all of their employees and merged them into a single data structure. Now, that's a big bite. And not all of them were big companies. You know, some of them were 20 and some of them were 150. Mm-hmm. But to consolidate all those into, a global employee database system was something to tackle. It would have been better if they would have all been looking like, you know, brothers and sisters instead of enemies and friends, you know. So I think that's good to get on the record. Thank you.
Okay. The last point I would just make on this slide is the timeline at the bottom, and I just can't underscore this is given what we know today, and I expect over the next few months as we have a better understanding, especially about what it's going to take to do the legacy work, that we'll be able to be more confident about our timeline, but this is given the knowledge that we had at this point in time. One other thing I just wanted to simply present that we're experiencing is just the resource impact to the schedule that we're on. You have a finite number of people in the agency who understand the business to the degree that is necessary to do this level of very complex work. And at this particular point in time, we have the business transition process, like we had talked about, moving some of the work from OHA to DHS, the design process for the new system. As I said, we've started data conversion design, and we've kicked off legacy design. And so one of the challenges that we are managing to is how do we mitigate the enormous load on staff to be able to be in all these things so that we have the right staff in the right place at the right time and try and structure our schedule in a way that we can have quality discussions with the people who need to be there to make sure we have the best design. And so I just bring that forward as you as a project can try and build a schedule that would meet certain needs, whether it's a funding need or what the vendor can provide. But as the state, we need to have the right people at the table to do the work. And there's a lot of different swim lanes of work going on for a project like this. So one of the things that I'm working hard as the project director to do is to make sure as we reestablish the schedule based on the delay that took place leading up to the MOU, that we try and structure this project in a manner that we have the people in the right place at the right time without burning them out severely. I'll turn it over to Nate to talk about the budget.
So
So what we have here are, you're going to see two slides that go over the budget numbers and where we're at. As Legislative Fiscal Officer Mr. Cummings shared with you, the project itself has gone through the Stage Gate 2, Stage Gate 3, just in your introduction, Mr. Cummings, shared at the beginning what we have for the total cost of the project. So Stage Gate 2 and Stage Gate 3, we saw an increase of the total cost for the projects, and those are shown here. The main reasons between those, we'd gone through the fit gap process. We'd gone through working around developing and trying to determine what we need to do staffing legacy and assumed maintenance and operation costs for those phases. Between then and what we're talking about now, in a minute we'll talk about some of the complexities, but we saw an increased growth from $177 million total funds to $241.7 million total funds. So that top line is total funds there, and the bottom lines roll up to those total numbers. And really those are around additional costs that we've seen associated with exploring and going deeper into what it would take to actually do this successfully here in Oregon. And so in the following slide, you have what was in the governor's recommended budget in the first column there. That's the original policy option budget request. We have the current policy option request in the center there, and then the difference. And so as a total funds difference, it's just short of $77 million. The majority of that, $45.7 million, is federal funds. It's an increase in additional state bonds request. There's, for DDI activities, actually less general fund needed because we won't enter into the maintenance and operation part of the project as we originally determined in our original scope and schedule. There's other fund limitation, which is how we pay for OIS activities as shared service. So it's limitations, other funds. And then debt services, an increase in debt services because of the increase of bonds. What I want to focus on.
Numbers are all biennial.
Yes.
Thank you.
And so the increase around these are really around several drivers that are listed below. We had an increase of expanding the time we're going to spend outside of maintenance and operation activities and doing design, development, and implementation activities. As a whole, these are usually costlier activities. They take more individuals. You're looking at more a larger focus. And many of these 6 months were around operational impacts. Previously, with Department of Human Services, my focus has been around operations. I work with aging people with disabilities, managing the operations for that area. As we looked at our rollout strategy and trying to achieve the overall effectiveness of using federal funds, we were shooting for a December 31st, 2018 deadline. That assumed we would do a pilot in 90 days and then roll out statewide in three waves at 1 month period with no breaks between. Currently, there isn't a single state that's made it out of a pilot stage in 90 days. The average is 120 days. And so we took that into account looking at our updated schedule. As well, many states talked about their strategies or concerns they had. Of the states that had concerns, over 70% of those states that we talked to identified the primary concern or area of stress that was greatest for them was implementation of the system, people actually using it. And so in looking at that, they suggested staggering. So we added additional time to make sure that as we rolled out statewide, we would have the time to be able to correct, to monitor, and make sure that we're adequately doing that. And so that added additional time to the actual implementation of the strategy. We added contingency to this project. We had no or limited contingency already in the original project ask, and so we added what was recommended ask of 10% contingency for this project. Cost out.
I'm sorry. Could you please repeat that? I want to make sure I understand.
Absolutely. So, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, in our original ask that we had for that was included in the governor's recommended budget, we had what would add up to about 3%, if you take some other columns, possibly 4% contingency. That takes the total funds we expect and has additional funds for time slippage, additional scope changes, issues that may arise, and having funds available to be able to use. The industry standard is somewhere between 10 and 15% for projects of these size. Legislative fiscal staff and other individuals had encouraged the department to do that, and the department in the initial ask had not brought that forward. And so we've corrected that in this ask as part of our budget request.
In a time of concern about being very careful about budgeting and fiscal constraint, I want to ask about that. Industry is always going to tell you, I would suppose, to increase the contingency, and then there will be reasons developed why you have to use the contingency, and you end up spending it. How often do we end up not spending the contingency, and we're able to use the money then for our regular programming purposes? Or does it pretty much always end up, oh, golly gee, we had to use it all?
If I may, Co-Chair Nathanson, for the Department Revenue Project, we had $4 million of contingency and we didn't use any of it. So I think it depends on the project. With this project, I see there could be opportunities outside even the contract work where there might be changes of scope. As I was going to mention on my next slide, or I might have mentioned earlier, is the project management resource for this project. It's difficult to find the caliber and capacity of project management resource to manage a project like this. My assessment coming in is I think we need to beef that up. I might need to procure some extra resource for that. And this, depending on how the budget is structured, I might need to use a little contingency for that. So it's not just for building or changing scope. There are multiple reasons why a contingency can be very, very valuable to a project to continue to keep it on pace.
But I do want to note and appreciate your pointing out that there was another project where we didn't have to use that contingency, and then the money was available to use for other public purposes.
Correct.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Additional costs and drivers that we had, cost allocation for the department hadn't been included in there, so the use of HR or our offer fiscal office or other parts of the department hadn't been included. Other fund limitation and the increase around that for shared services of OIS, we draw the funds into the department and we have what's called, and I always love discussing this topic, the unduplicated other fund limitation. Basically, it allows us to have OIS bill against our projects or the funds within each of the departments for the work they're doing. It's not actual additional funds, but it's a limitation that allows it. But it still shows as limitations part of this ask as an increased ask. So you have that incorporated in the numbers as well. Really, some of the other buckets that are important to point out, as I mentioned earlier, the increased understanding around the implementation work, there's additional staff for on-site support for the rollout, and taking the examples and lessons learned from the one system implementation that the Oregon Health Authority went through, there's a lot of opportunity for us to have additional support for that. There's increased work around the legacy, looking at those legacy systems and understanding the scope of staffing that would be necessary to make sure we engage and know how those systems continue to work. And then increased capacity around disaster recovery work. And as was mentioned earlier, bringing that into scope and making sure that we're continuing on that work in a thoughtful manner around this project. And so those were the drivers that really pushed forward on this budget.
Two slides left, if I may. We've talked a lot about challenges. I thought I'd bring them to one slide just towards the end here, the key challenges, so that we could see the scope of those. We've talked about the legacy system complexity, the data conversion complexity, moving to the integrated service model. We've talked about people readiness and the system adoption, as Nate just addressed, the finite number of subject matter experts and managing to that resource level. One of the things we didn't talk about yet is just rolling out. When we roll out, we'll roll out geographically, which means we'll be running in parallel systems. So certain portions of the state will be supported by legacy, and then certain portions of the state will be supported by the new system. That's a challenging business model, but it's the one that we're required to do by the feds, and so we're going to continue to do that. The other thing that we are managing as a leadership team is this: both organizations' capacity to handle a major project like this while doing everything else in light of the budget environment. We're seeing a number of retirements that are coming in just very recently as people are talking about PERS reform. And so there's just an awful lot of dimensions to the environment that we're in that we're trying to marshal this project through all the work that goes on in both agencies at the same time. And I'd say that there's a very good network from my perspective, sitting in the middle as an independent project director, very good collaboration between both agencies and the governance processes that they have to manage their priorities, and I have felt very supported, and so I just thought I'd mention that. You asked the question about the unknown changes. I think we've addressed that. It's on our radar. It's something that will happen or could happen, and when it does, we'll need to respond to that. I just mentioned as my example about contingency, my observation is that we're going to have to shore up the project management office to make sure that this thing is managed as well as it possibly can be. The people who are there are doing a very good job. It's under-resourced, and nobody in that building has done a $240 million project before. And then the last bullet that's not on this slide that I just want to mention is just looking ahead to managing expectations. One of the challenges that I can see coming down the road is that it's one thing to go live, and I'm speaking from my experience in another department. But after you go live, there are still a great deal of work that's going to go on, and you're going to have a shakedown period where you're going to do your best for your data conversion strategies, but there's going to be things that won't go perfectly. You're going to have new business processes that you thought were wonderful in design, but as you're executing them in operations, they're going to have to be modified. And so I wanted to start early to manage expectations that when we go live, we will continue to have to mature and manage this project till we get to the point where we've normalized and it's our new operating normal. And then finally, our go-forward steps. This was a key step for us today to meet and present with you and hear from the LFO their recommendation. It's our plan, I believe, to go forward to the Human Services Subcommittee sometime in the near future and have a similar conversation with them as we go through the budget process. And we're in process of initiating the renegotiation of the Deloitte contract, as well as many other things that are going on at this time. But those are some of the key points. And that concludes our presentation.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a question now that relates not so much to the project budget, but it probably relates to what contract you've either already signed or would be signing. So in 2019, end of June-ish, the thing goes live. And I want to ask about two kinds of changes and what it's going to cost us, whether we will have the ability to just make a change to our system or whether you're going to have to come back to the legislature and say, gee, we need, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars to do something. So let's say that there's something as simple as a percentage that needs to be changed. It's related to eligibility or what a benefit is going to be. Instead of being 100% of this number, it's going to be 97% of this number. So you just need to change a number. Are you going to have to come back to the legislature and ask for funding to change a number?
Well, I'll take an initial cut, but I'll ask Mr. Singer here to help me out. As I understand it, with the business rules engine and trying to build the system in a way that for those types of table changes or whatnot, that we should be able to manage that kind of work. If it's a larger policy change or something that's different that's going to need the help of a vendor, which is common, and it's outside the scope of a maintenance and operations agreement that's there, then there may be, in a fiscal impact, some sort of an estimate for the additional work. But that's my expectation, but I look to Nate to validate that.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, it really depends, members of the committee, sorry, it really depends on the scope of the change. For a simple change, there are tables that we would be able to. As we approach and come into the next year, we'll be looking at how we move forward with the maintenance and operation strategy, so how the system's maintained, exploring, you know, what that process will be, and depending on what's in that agreement could also affect whether or not. For the most part, the goals in these systems, while they're complex and the part of the excitement or opportunity is the efficiencies we will get around staff, right now, staff across the state in every one of your areas, if they're doing eligibility, do it in their head, do it with worksheets, do it on pads and paper, and do it very well in that manner, but don't have the ability to really have an automated system. Some of the downstream impacts of an automated system, sometimes it has less flexibility for some of the changes, and that's the balance that we're trying to make sure that we strive for. The tables that we have and the work that we're doing hopefully will allow that flexibility for many of those types of changes when it comes to income standards, percentages, and things that regularly change around our business.
I'm going to ask one other kind of change that could be made. I'm totally making this up, but it's similar to something that I asked to be done a few years ago, and someone told me it would be $374,000 to add one question to one form. And you can imagine that I came unglued and objected and said, I couldn't believe we signed a contract that got us in a position where to add one question to one form, not even a table that's determining eligibility, just to ask a question to be able to record the answer that was a yes, no answer, was that much money. So let's say that we didn't anticipate that we would want to collect information about whether someone would be needing assistance, whether it means call dial-a-ride or some sort of monetary assistance, for transportation to get either to healthcare appointments or to get to a counseling or a job training site or whatever. We forgot to build in that we needed to ask the question, do you need transportation assistance? That would probably be a little more difficult. But is someone thinking about what it's going to cost to add that kind of a simple question?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, yes. Part of this and the opportunity we have is the Oregon Health Authority currently is utilizing the One System. They have a maintenance and operation agreement in place. They regularly have to determine whether a change of adding a question will be that maintenance and operation, or if it's a cost that's larger, that would be a change request or an additional scope, similar to a lot of the work they've done in the enhancement work that was authorized by the legislature. One of the drivers to that really will be whether or not it's needed for eligibility or if it goes to downstream systems. But we are looking at that, and those will be parts of the key negotiations that we'll be doing with the vendor that is chosen to do maintenance operation in coordination with OIS and our other partners.
And if I may, Co-Chair Nathanson, the ideal for these projects is to build them in a way that the state can support and maintain and operate it as much as possible. But when they're custom systems that are built by a vendor, there are certain things that we just can't get away from. And so I'm sorry we can't answer your questions more specifically. I guess the answer, and it's one I get a lot, is it depends. And it's definitely something that's front and center in our thinking is how can we build these systems so that the state can have as much control over maintaining them as possible within our budget and not have to go outside. And we hear you. We hear the nature of your questions and take that to heart.
Thank you. That's what I needed to hear.
Thank you.
I would like to offer, if you have a question, you can send it to us, Co-Chair Nathanson.
Thank you.
Other questions? LFO, do you have information for us and a recommendation?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, the LFO does. I would like to frame our recommendation. As you notice, it's a fairly robust list of instructions. I prefer to call it robust. Others called it wordy. But the issues that have been brought up here are things that we have discussed in detail for the last 4, 5, or 6 months. The Office of the State CIO, Eric Smith, Nate Singer, Kristen Dewis, Wayne Haddad, every IT-er in this room has had concerns about customization, about making sure that our maintenance contracts with the vendor have enough room in them so that we can do work without having to come in and pay for every single option. Those, in an ideal world, we would have stopped, spent 4, 5, or 6 months redoing a lot of things. This was a major change to what we were doing. We identified 50 or 60 major risks that we felt we had to deal with. There was a lot to be done. We did not have the option of stopping. We have a vendor on board that's billing us at $2 to $3 million a month. We have federal money deadline 90-10 that's going away. We had no option but to go very quickly through a disciplined off-ramp major project variance process and look at risks and try to get the ones that we could mitigated, and those that we couldn't or where concerns were still there because of the magnitude. Understand, this project was $126 million at Stage Gate 2. It's 240 now. It's jumped $77 million from September of last year. And yet, I want to remind everybody that if you tried to write this stuff from scratch, 240 would seem cheap. And that we cannot forget. I want to also remind everyone that Representative Nathanson brought up in the hearing a while back that this is not a technology problem. This is a problem of providing services to Oregonians that needs to be done, and the way it's being done now manually is not acceptable. And you will be doing this sooner or later, whether you're doing it on federal money or state money. So the opportunity to do it now is important. The ITers have reservations because of the questions, and that's why the budget note is robust. But I believe that I know that Nate for sure knows, and I believe that that you do also, young man, that we've got a lot of questions to answer between now and September. And so we've built those into this process, recognizing that this is the best numbers they can come up with where they're at. We still have areas of concern. I want to make sure that Dr. Pettit's and his staff's concerns are there, and they are in the budget notes. And we feel comfortable in going forward with the work that's been done. I would say that this group has not pushed back or not refused to do anything we've asked. And I cannot tell you what a breath of fresh air that is to have an agency that will say, you're right, that needs to be done, and they're not parroting it. They understand it's the right thing to do. So I wanted to frame that way because they will be back in September, and we hope that those numbers will be rock solid. But I don't believe for a moment that that Mr. Smith would be willing to put one of his children as up as collateral for that yet.
Maybe and, one of them.
And I can assure one is probably just misbehaving, I'm sure. But at this particular point, I say that not to take anything away from the great work that the folks have done, but let's understand this is very difficult. And that said, we put together a very robust set of instructions. And like I said, I believe that everyone in the room that's an ITer agrees that these things need to be done. They may not all get done by September, and that's why I've asked for you to report progress recommending. But in any event, I just wanted you to be aware of why this is such a robust set of instructions and stuff and why it's so specific. This is a big deal, and we want to do it right. And if we do it right this way, we won't worry about the end date. We will do what needs to be done. And even if the costs do adjust, I can assure you that the cost for writing this from scratch would dwarf what's on this particular request here. That said, as more fully described in the detailed recommendations made on page 6 through 8, the memo posted on OLIS, ALFO recommends incremental conditional approval of POP option package 201. Assuming the spending authority and personnel resources are made available to the Department of Human Services within Senate Bill 5526 and to the Oregon Health Authority, OHA, within House Bill 5026. LFO further recommends that the entire expenditure limitation be unscheduled by the Department of Administrative Services and that the Department of Human Services be required to request the OSCIO, CFO, and LFO approval that a portion or all the remaining unscheduled expenditure limitation will be rescheduled for the agency to use to initiate and complete the remaining 1IE and ME project execution activities. We did verify with the agency that they have sufficient funds to get through the end of the legislative session where we can take a look at the rescheduling at that point. Okay, so that's our recommendation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move adoption of the LFO recommendation, and I'll speak to that after we...
May Go I? Ahead. Yes.
So one of the things that staff just said is that we want to do it right, and if we it takes a little longer than we thought, we still want to do it right. One of the things that I've always said is 5 years after we're done, no one will remember that we were a couple of months late, but everyone will remember if we did it wrong. So with that, I do move the adoption of the recommendation.
Thank you. Discussion. Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Chair Nathanson. So I kind of agree with Senator Riley's sentiments there. Also say there's some things in here that make me nervous about the persistence of the legacy systems makes me nervous. The inability to do data conversion makes me nervous. But I agree with the kind of the general tone of the recommendation that we don't really have a choice. We kind of have to go forward with this. So I hope this is successful, and I hope 5 years later they look back and. Or they don't look back because there's no reason to look back, whatever. But anyway.
Great. Any other discussion? I would. Yes, Senator.
We sit in an interesting position, especially Senator DeBoer and myself coming into this as the new guys. And the enormous amounts of money that we see expended for management information services and systems and whatnot is nearly mind-boggling. And because we're coming to the party late, what we don't see is the initial planning ADP. APD that got created is part of the state's vision and an understanding of what the deficiencies are and how to solve those and whatever. It's very difficult to say that this there's a legitimate $55 million, stage gate increase from 2 to 3, and then the projected grand total is out here. These numbers are just astronomical, and I think we do ourselves a disservice just to say, well, we're stuck, we got to do it, and slam the hammer down. Yet I realize I don't know what I don't know, and it's an enormous wad of information. Because we don't see the background material, the slides are well presented and put together, but there's still no there's no detail, there's no granular information to determine that $55 million increase from stage gate to stage gate is worth the money. What is it we're actually getting other than a projection out into the future? I'll summarize. You hear my fear of what we're about to accomplish here, but earlier there was this question about contingency. And if there's contingency and an increase in contingency, doesn't the contingency usually get spent? Anecdotally, the answer is, oh, no. But experientially, the answer is, oh, yes. And so it's very difficult to jump in and weigh these. I recognize the need for change. I recognize the legacy systems. I, too, have reservations about preserving those and planning for those and whatnot. What we ought to be doing is detonating those and moving on into the new world. And that may sound more expensive than what we're looking at. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. For my final remark, I would like to point out, first of all, thank you for handling my questions and noting the concerns of the various committee members. And I'm going to read a short excerpt from the LFO findings, which I think are significant, and I just want them to be on the record with us today. The LFO concurs with the overall go-forward plan and justifications, including resource requests provided by the ONE and IE and ME project team, et cetera. It goes on to say, despite the significant increase in scope, associated cost increases, to your point, and the many risks identified in going forward, the project still makes solid business, technical, and financial sense. So that's how I'm basing my decision to say yes to this motion. Yeah, Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask for two things, that if the contingency is tapped, that at least the chairs or co-chairs get information and ask before it is tapped. Mm-hmm. And I'd also like to see a report that Nate brought up of where that $4 million in contingency, how it was returned back, that he spoke of from DOR. So, I mean, it's a good example that we should. So, thank you.
Yes.
I may be able to address, mm-hmm. if I may, co-chairs, members of the committee. At DOR, they had a different business problem in that they were able to bring in a COT solution that was well known in 20 other states, and the contingency was put in there less for the solution that was being brought in, but more for the things outside of that. We had a fixed price, deliverables-based contract, and so it's really a unique, an untypical IT problem that DOR had the fortune of solving. This is a much more complex and different challenge. This is more mainstream with the types of IT projects that are like a transfer system or a design build, where the contingency is just like in capital construction projects. It's for the things that you haven't seen yet, the things that you don't know. And so I just point out the distinguishment between those two projects. I mean, yes, there is a project where there was contingency brought back, and the way it was returned, it was bond funds, and so they weren't requested. I mean, the bond sold, but the money wasn't used.
Mr. McSpadden.
Very quickly, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer. John Borden is the LFO budget analyst for the Department of Revenue. We can get that detailed information for you and the committee members.
Thank you, John. Any other discussion? Objections to the motion? Motion passes. That's the end of our single but very big agenda item. The work session is closed, and I'm adjourning the meeting.
So very good points. I really appreciate. So very good points.